Hello, and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast for May the 15th, 2020. This is episode number 6. On today's show, we're discussing Tesla reopening its Fremont factory and threatening to leave for Texas/Nevada. Electrify America says it will transition to charging by the kilowatt hour. And we compare the Hyundai Kona Electric and the Chevy Bolt EV. And much, much more. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dominic Chione, Inside EV's editor and Inside EV's forum moderator. Joining us today, we have Tom Logney, longtime EV advocate and Inside EV's editor. We also have Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, available on all your usual podcast platforms. And finally, we have Kyle Connor from the Out of Spec Motoring and One Lap YouTube channels. He also puts together awesome videos for the Inside EV's YouTube channel. Go and subscribe and tap on that notifications bell. We are streaming live on YouTube, which means that if you're watching us right now, you can ask us questions and leave us comments via the YouTube chat. So welcome, gentlemen of the panel and ladies and gentlemen of the audience. Lots to talk about today. But before we get to the big news, let's see, what do we have charging up in your driveways this week? Tom, what do you got?
All right, so I just returned the Chevy Bolt EV, 2020 Chevy Bolt EV, and got a new 2020 BMW X330e plug-in hybrid. So I've only had it a couple days, don't have a lot to comment on it. It's an interesting vehicle, really, really well-appointed, fantastic ride. And I'm getting about 20 miles per charge, which is, you know, not bad for only a 10 kilowatt hour total size battery, maybe 11 kilowatt hour total. I think it's about 10 usable. I'm finding that when I recharge it, it's consuming just about 10 kilowatt hours. So I guess that's about the usable amount. But I'll have more to report on that vehicle next week.
All right. And what do you have, Kyle?
Well, last week was the good week because I had the Chevy Bolt, the 2020. We're going to be talking about that car later today. Bigger battery pack, really awesome. I did about, I don't know, 1,500 miles in that car. And then I had the Hyundai Kona Electric, which is pretty much the same as the earlier versions, but finally with a battery heater. I wasn't able to test it. It was kind of warm out, but that's only available on the mid and top trim, the limited and ultimate. I think I got those words right. I thought that was pretty odd. They wouldn't include it in the base one, but better than nothing. I really like that car. New UI changes. I'll have some more things out on that in the future. And what else did I have? I had the Volvo V60 Polestar. I had that car for 2 weeks. And that just went back. I wrote a full review of it on Inside EVs that went live this morning. So if you haven't yet, go type in V60 in the search somewhere in Inside EVs and you'll find it. It's like 2,000 words about how it drives around a racetrack. It's awesome. And then I just got a Lexus LS500H, which is the big luxury executive sedan. It's like $100,000+ from Lexus. It's a hybrid, and it has a 6-cylinder engine with a 4-speed automatic and a 6-speed CVT simulated on top of that automatic. It's very confusing, and it has great massaging seats, and I was chauffeured to Chick-fil-A yesterday in the back by my friend. It was awesome, but no plug on it. It would be better if it had some more electrification. I don't know what Toyota's doing, but that car needs a plug.
Agreed. So, Kyle and Tom, you both had a chance to recently drive the Bolt and the Kona. So, and we did some tests. If you look back on Inside of Ease, we have a nice comparison video that you put together for us, Kyle. Want to tell us a little bit about that? What we did?
Right. So, the video that's gone up as to the filming of this podcast is a quick drag race on the Inside EV's YouTube channel that I did with my girlfriend Alyssa. She was a good sport, and you know, we're trying to keep few people around. So, she drove the Bolt, I drove the Kona. I won't give away the ending, but actually, you know what? I will.
You can.
Yeah. There's nothing in between the cars, like, they are the exact same acceleration. We floored it at the same time, 100% state of charge on both cars, and they're just dead even. They both output 160 kilowatt max. I don't really know the weight difference between the two, but I know it's not much. And I'm just so impressed with like how similar these two are in terms of price range. I also did a range test, 70 mile per hour range test for the out of spec channel, but I'll have an article on Inside EVs about it. And they came within 0.6 of a mile, something like that. Under
as far as the range?
Similar, yeah, very similar conditions. It was like 228.7 miles versus 229 point something else. And
was that your 70 mile an hour test, or was that your normal driving loop test?
No, 70 miles per hour, just set the cruise on the highway, do the same loop. I was lucky that the conditions on both days were very similar. And the Kona has a 2 kilowatt hour smaller battery pack, but went slightly farther. So it's a little bit more efficient than the Bolt, which to be expected, it's a newer car.
So, but it's weird though, because the Bolt is built from the ground up to be an EV. So you would think that would be better. Plus it's, I don't know if it's a little bit lower, but it seems a bit more streamlined. So it's kind of
the Bolt. Taller than the Kona.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Okay. It doesn't look like it from the outside, but when you park them next to each other, the Kona has like, is shorter by like an inch.
Right. This is the deceptive vehicle, the Bolt, I find.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think of the Bolt as like a hot hatchback, like a Volkswagen Golf in terms of size. And then the Kona I think of as a small SUV, when in reality, the Bolt has more space and is slightly bigger than the Kona is. It all just has to do, I think, with the plastic cladding on the side of the Kona to make it look beefed up.
Right. And the Bolt has a short front end too, and it's kind of like slanted down more than the Kona.
Yeah, I mean, I did another review, which was kind of a silly thing for out of spec, where we compared the cars under a series of challenges to see like which is faster in reverse and what can get around a corner faster. And the Kona is the better car, like no question. It sort of has a better interior. It's a better place to pass the time. The Bolt, though, is a better, not faster, but feels better to drive on the limit. It's much more of a controllable chassis. I think that's the benefit of having a ground-up design meant for an electric vehicle. The Bolt isn't twitchy. When you really get the Kona into a corner, it starts to twitch around. Traction control isn't tuned right. It has some weird quirks. I do like the Bolt in terms of a performer, but I would go for the Kona personally to drive every day just because of adaptive cruise control, lane centering, cooled seats, head-up display, all these nice little features.
So you did some range tests with these two vehicles too, didn't you, Tom?
Yeah, well, I've tested the Kona in the past. Recently now, I just had the Bolt. I'm actually getting a Kona in 2 weeks.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
So I'll be able to kind of double up on what Kyle did. We've been doing that lately, which seems to work, where we each do our own independent tests and then compare them. It's better than having one data point. Two is better than one. So I'll be doing that with the Kona soon. But as far as what Kyle said with the cars being evenly matched, I agree 100%. It's almost as if Hyundai went out and told their engineers, okay, see this Bolt, just make one of those for us. Because the price is within a couple hundred dollars of each other. The battery size is nearly identical. The EPA rated range is 1 mile an hour different. One mile different, not mile an hour different. The weight is very close. The quarter mile times, as Kyle noted, are nearly identical. Even Road and Track tested them, and it was like 0.2 second difference in their quarter mile time. They're nearly every metric, these two cars are exactly alike. So, it's basically just decide which one you like better, but also which one can you get. Here in the U.S., it's really hard to get a Kona. They're not importing many of them in here. There's, I know people that have been on waiting lists for months for them. You do get the federal tax credit where you don't on the Bolt, but the Bolts are available. And GM also does typically give heavy discounts, factory to dealer discounts on the Bolt to kind of offset the fact that you don't get the federal discount on the vehicle anymore. So, it's basically pick your poison. These cars are both technically extremely similar. They can both do about the same thing. They have offer about the same amount of utility and function. So which one do you like better?
The Bolt, I've seen some MRS manufacturers suggest retail price down in the 25,000 range.
Yeah, they're like 10 grand off the hood of these things in some places.
Absolutely. I mean, GM recognizes that losing that federal tax credit is going to kill the sales of the vehicle because it makes it uncompetitive to comparable vehicles. So, you know, they're stepping up and taking it on the chin. They're subsidizing the car, which, you know, you don't like to see, but it's necessary at this point.
So are there any deals on the Kona? Do we know?
Not that I know of. I know people that are happy to pay MSRP for them because they're in such limited supply.
I don't know the case right now, but I know last year my dad, I had mentioned in the previous podcast, bought two of them. And he got, you know, at different times, and he was able to go a few thousand dollars under sticker. But this was in like a dealer in Connecticut in Stamford Hyundai. And they had like 10 of them on the lot. Like they just, and that no one wanted them. So, you know, I'm sure the awareness of the car has picked up since then. And it's, you know, much harder to get, like Tom was saying. But I would go to some of these weird small dealers in small ZEV states, Maryland, Connecticut, things like this. Just buy the car and ship it to wherever you are. I mean, maintenance, it really doesn't need anything per se. Just, you know, I would say the Kona's worth buying out of a ZEV state and shipping, as long as it's not too unreasonable. Shipping's cheap. And living with that car over a Bolt, although I do see the benefit of the Bolt. When you start talking low to mid $20,000 range for a brand new car, that's crazy. That is so much car for the money.
That's true. We do have a couple of owners on the Inside EVs forum from non-ZEV states or states where they don't sell the Kona. I believe it's available in like 14 states maybe. And yeah, they just have them shipped down and you know, so far so good. And if they have an issue or problems, they, you know, throw out questions on the forum and other owners chime in and help them out. But it's, actually they've been, for the most part, owners have been doing pretty well. And we have a couple watching the stream now and telling us how much they love driving the car. It's fun to drive. It was difficult to buy a Kona in Finland, according to John 72392. So you did a couple Chevy Bolt range tests this week, didn't you, Tom?
Kyle and I had the vehicle basically at the similar time. He had a couple days ahead of me. He did his 70-mile-an-hour range test, and then I repeated the same thing up here in New Jersey on the New Jersey Turnpike. I have a set course where I've been doing all of the highway miles, 70-mile-an-hour range tests, so we can compare vehicle to vehicle on the same track in basically the same conditions. I came up a little bit short of Kyle. Kyle finished up with 228 miles. But he's able to run the car till it stopped moving because he finishes his, which is awesome. He finishes his range test up at the Inside EV's track, and he can just circle the track until the car goes into reduced power mode and stops moving. I can't do that on the New Jersey Turnpike. You know, at you know, best case scenario, I pull over to the side of the road and I call AAA. Worst case scenario, you know, a tractor trailer plows into me and, you know,
typical New Jersey thing.
So I map out where the car, during my drive, luckily there's a bunch of charging stations and I can do loops. So I know I'm finishing up right about when the car should be dead. And I've been getting it pretty close. So I finished up with 1% state of charge on the Bolt. I used 64 of the 66 kilowatt hours that are available. Kyle used 65.9 of the 66 kilowatt hours available. I used 64 and I went 218 miles. So if you add those, the 2 kilowatt hours I didn't use at the consumption rate that both Kyle and I both had, which was 3.4 miles per kilowatt hour, I finished up at around 224 miles. He did 228. So, you know, that's pretty much dead even. The wind was a little bit different when I was driving. And again, I was driving all at 70 miles an hour. So when he comes off the highway and he's on his track for the last mile or two, he can't do that 70 miles an hour. His consumption, you know, will go up a little bit. So it pretty much validates that, you know, the Bolt EV at a constant 70 miles an hour under regular conditions, you know, about 50, 60, 70 degrees out, not a lot of wind, relatively flat driving, it's good for about 225 miles per charge.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's important to note, not necessarily on this particular topic, but just all range tests. What Tom does is awesome, and it gives a really perfect picture of the car straight on the highway, basically when you pull off. And I think that's probably more realistic than what I'm doing. Obviously, our numbers are almost exact. I'm definitely going up and down the highway forever. But I pull off the highway at 1 or 2, maybe 3% battery state of charge, and then I finish up around the track. And what I'm also testing is not just range, but battery pack capacity. Now, the manufacturer can say, you know, what their battery pack size is, but one, is it the case that that's true? What's usable of that battery pack size? Sometimes they state that, sometimes they don't. And the only way to test capacity, because hidden buffers, especially when the pack's new, is to go 100% and drain it till it stops moving. And that is a little bit of a different test than the range test. I compile them into one test because I don't want to sit in the car for 3 days straight. But when Tom, this was a unique opportunity where we had the same car under similar but not identical conditions. And it was just awesome to see like validation that our testing procedures are very similar. It'll never be exact, but it was great to just see we're doing something right.
So when you run the battery down, do you then use the car's readout to tell you how much battery power energy that you add back? Or do you have like a kilowatt meter on the wall that's measuring that?
The problem with putting it on the wall and looking at, you know, what energy goes into the car. We talked about this at the end of our Mini Cooper SE review, is you have a couple different things working. If you have a meter on the wall, all of the energy that comes out of that wall socket and into the car is not going to make it into the battery pack. Some of it will run pumps to cool it. Some of it will evaporate as heat loss. So, and of course there's plenty other things that can use up small amounts of juice. So you have to rely on what the car tells you, as that's going to be the most accurate form of looking at what's gone through that battery. There's no perfect way. Like the Kona, for example, doesn't show you how much energy you used. So I wasn't able to do a capacity test on that car. Okay. I mean, we can extrapolate the data with based on this consumption at this speed, here's how much energy we used, but it will never be a perfect exact number.
So really quickly, Kyle, how fast does the Kona charge?
This is the big differentiation between the two cars. The Kona will do 76, 77 kilowatt peak. I've fast charged them maybe 50 times, maybe a little bit more, because I've done thousands of miles in the Kona now. I've never seen regularly over 75 kilowatt. Very occasionally it pops up to 76. I've never seen 77 on the screen. The Bolt does 55 kilowatt. I did fast charge this car twice, but not a full charge like Tom did, so he can speak to the Bolt's charging curve because I didn't get to test it. Tom, did you notice this updated curve where it doesn't fall off ledges anymore and they claim it should smooth out towards the end?
Yeah, definitely. I didn't do a complete charging test on a pre-2020 Bolt to compare. I wish I had, but the data's out there. We can look at it, you know, that other people have done. But what I did notice was that the Bolt jumped up to 53 kilowatts pretty quickly and held it. It was bouncing between 52 and 53. I never saw 55, and I'm a little surprised why, because the battery temperature was nice and warm.
That shouldn't have been a problem. Kilowatt, it can handle that, no problem. It's not getting hot from that.
Yeah, and I was a little surprised why it never reached its exact peak of 55, but 52, 53 is pretty close. It held 52, 53 for most of the charging session. You could take a look at the video. It's on Inside EVs. I did a time-lapse video of the entire charging session from 4 minutes up to 4% up to 80%. It took an hour and 10 minutes, which is probably, I believe that is the longest it will take any EV to charge from 0 to 80%. I don't think there's another electric vehicle out there that takes longer than that, than to go from 0 to 80%. Now, partly because the Bolt has such a big battery, you know, you can't say that, well, the i3 is a better car because it charges faster to 80%. Well, it only has a 42 kilowatt hour battery and the Bolt has a 66. So, you know, it's, I'm not saying that it's better than that, but, with having such a large battery, it's really an Achilles heel for the Bolt that it's limited to 55 kilowatt charging. You know, any EV with a battery that's bigger than, say, 50 kilowatt hour should have 75 or 100 kilowatt DC fast charging capability. I think we're going to see that in the future. I think this is just kind of like growing pains of the industry. And when the Bolt first came out, there were no DC fast chargers that were faster than 50 kilowatts. So that's why they didn't, they set it at that rate. And I guess they just haven't improved upon it yet, you know, so, but I'm sure we'll see that in future iterations of the Bolt, faster charging. But for now, it's painful on long trips. If you want to cover hundreds and hundreds of miles, it's really painful to sit there and wait, you know, an hour, hour and a half, probably 2 hours if you had to go to 100%. But other than that, I mean, the Bolt's a great little EV, but its DC fast charge rate really needs to be improved.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm not sure if in my mind, I'm thinking that it's not going to be changed for the refresh that's coming out next year, the Bolt that's refresh with the new interior. And so I don't expect that the Bolt EUV, a slightly larger Bolt, will have that either. But then from then on, all the other GM products will have like the Cadillac Lyriq and the GMC Hummer EV. Those should all have like much faster charging speeds, fast charging speeds. But let's move on to some news. So this week, like the big issue kind of all over the EV world was, of course, Tesla related as it often is, and their CEO, Elon Musk. And so the Tesla Fremont factory is reopened, and Musk has said the headquarters and maybe future programs are moving to Texas and or Nevada. So I've got a couple notes here I can run through real quick just to give an overview of the situation. So there was like I said, a ton of drama surrounding this. The factory was originally shut down on the 23rd of March. That's March. Now it's April, and now it's May. And then over a month later, during the company's Q1 call with analysts, he referred to these restrictions as fascist. Elon Musk, he's not very happy about the whole situation, and he's been downplaying the whole coronavirus situation to some extent about its, you know, lethality and spread, etc. So anyway, fast forward to last Saturday when the Alameda County failed to allow the company to resume operations. The lockdown had been extended to the 31st of May, which is like the end of the month. And, you know, Elon just kind of lost it at that point. And he took to Twitter on Saturday to announce that they were filing a lawsuit against the county. And they did so in federal court. In the tweet, he also called the interim health officer at Alameda County unelected and ignorant, which I don't know, you know, why you're insulting people on Twitter when you're a CEO, but okay. A few minutes later, he announced that he's moving the headquarters and future programs to Texas/Nevada immediately, and maybe even eventually the Fremont manufacturing, a move some have called a bluff. Personally, I don't think Elon does a lot of bluffing, but I guess we'll see. Later on that day, they also released a return to work safety plan that Tesla did, and it's on their Tesla blog. You can go and read that. There's a big PDF file, all the safety precautions they're taking, and, you know, it looked pretty good. So, of course, surrounding all this, there was like a mixture of outrage and praise. The governor of California voiced his support, as did the mayor of Fremont, the mayor of Palo Alto, where the Tesla headquarters is actually located across the bay from the factory. They also chimed in with some report. On Tuesday, the president of the United States tweeted that California should let Tesla reopen, even though it's the county and not the state with the lockdown order here. And then on the other side, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who somebody I generally agree with and like, tweeted that Elon was threatening to take away people's jobs unless he was allowed to risk their health, and called it capitalism at its worst. Then California Democrat Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez from the San Diego area, way down in the south of the state, tweeted F Elon, and then went on to complain that Tesla had the gall to take advantage of the subsidies that were granted by the government that she's a part of. Anyway, and he responded to that tweet saying message received. So it's what a craziness. So there were some reports of activity at the Fremont factory that Saturday, with Model 3s being moved out to the parking lot and some car carrier trucks moving around. And there were some reports that a worker or two had reported that some work had started. But regardless, on Monday, Elon tweeted again that they are starting production and that he would be on the line, and requested that if anyone is arrested, it should be him. Then I saw a little report with the Fremont chief of police, who would be the force that would would be the people that would enforce that order. And he didn't seem like he was really inclined to get involved with it at all. And so the upshot of this is that the county has relented and agreed to allow the plant to open by the 18th. That's this coming Monday. But of course, they've been, they're for all, you know, intents and purpose, they're already open and working and getting geared up. But the 18th is the same date that GM, Ford, and Fiat Chrysler plants are also begin gearing up their manufacturing again. So it's not like Tesla's a huge outlier, and other plants like the Mercedes plant in Alabama, they've been up for a couple of weeks already. So that's kind of the situation. Oh, and not one to let anything go, of course. Elon was on Twitter again last night reiterating that SpaceX has 8,000 employees that have been working this whole time because of the national security exemption. And they had zero deaths or serious illnesses, though they did actually have six workers confirmed to have contracted the virus. So that was a lot. Martin, what's your take on all this?
Well, look, first of all, no one's covered themselves in any glory throughout this whole situation. No one's come out of this smelling of roses. And too often at times, this debate descended into, firstly, a slanging match, as you said, via Twitter, which is how Elon likes to do his business. And that's his call. But also, elected officials using profanity is not the way to go about business for those people. So there has been a real lack of adult debate around this. Then, if anyone possibly on the internet says anything that disagrees with a certain subset of the internet, they then get the full force of those. And yes, I'm talking about a very narrow 1%, no, 0.1% of Elon's followers who do really define the phrase fanatical. And if I, for instance, this week on the podcast mentioned that at times I don't think he's conducted himself as a CEO should and in the best way, I then get personal attacks and I get people coming for me. So really? Which is fine. That's, you know, that's all right. I'm a big boy and I got thick skin, but it just shows
he's such a nice guy though.
He's a lovely guy. Why would his followers be so aggressive? But it just shows that there is a tiny proportion, but that's the internet, isn't it? Who are very juvenile and just don't conduct themselves in a way that I just ignore. I mean, I know some people engage, but I just ignore, block or whatever. I more often than not just kind of turn the page and move on. So there's that issue as well. There's a real lack of debate I've found around this issue, which is, number one, it's the personal safety of everybody involved. And that surely comes first. We can't make cars if we're all sick. The second thing is, if nobody goes to work, so if there is no economy, well, then there is no healthcare system. So we all want to be well. We all want to stay at home. We all want to protect our healthcare systems, whatever form it takes in the country that you live in. But without an economy, without going to work and producing things, there is no income. There are no taxes. There are no healthcare systems. So this is a really nuanced balancing act. And I'm not saying that we all have to stroke our chins and have high-level debates every second of the day, but at least, can we at least just raise the tide a little bit with some of the conversation that's been going on? We all want to see people going back to work and doing their job that hopefully they enjoy, making great products or not, whatever you do. If you can't do your job from home, and many people watching this can't, they physically have to go to a location to do their job. Number one, let's have a grown-up conversation about how to make it safe and to ensure that them, their loved ones, their family, and they or everyone stays safe. And too much of this debate has been about throwing mud and slinging insults. And then the PR offensive that Tesla came out with maybe Sunday, was it Sunday morning or Sunday night, depending on where you're watching this. They then came out with that big PDF document of how they've done it, which was very much 24 hours maybe afterwards after the lawsuit had been issued. All of this, I think, could have been solved by just pressing pause on so many Twitter send buttons, just taking a breath. Do I need to send this? And actually, if Tesla had kind of come out earlier with, this is what we did in China, like this is what we're doing, they could have led that narrative. They could have led the story and gone, it's absolutely fine. As it was, so they got some bad publicity. Officials got bad publicity. Everyone's bought bad publicity on themselves. And the whole situation's really, really unsavory. Hey, it's only my personal It's only my personal take. I'd love to know in the comments what you think of this. Obviously, if you're watching this live on YouTube, you've got the chat. You can interact with us afterwards as well. Let me know I'm out of order, but please do it in a nice adult way. And throughout all of this, hopefully, we've got back to some sort of degree of normality now. As you say, officially, it all starts on Monday the 18th, but unofficially, they're making cars now and shipping them out. I hope everybody there is safe and okay, and that all the car makers are able to put those things in place for people to go back and do their jobs safely. Hey, that's my take. I don't know what you guys think.
That's a great take, actually. You know, it's they did have a great opportunity to lead the conversation and, you know, put that plan out there and, you know, really have a very positive message. But it was everything in the backwards, you know, insults and ultimatums. And Kyle, I see you nodding your head there. What's going on?
Oh, man, I'm going to stay out of this one. I'm really curious just to see what everyone thinks. I think it's I love watching stuff unfold and seeing how people feel about it. I personally don't know. I can go either way on this. I see Elon's side. I see the right. Everyone else's side. I have no clue. I'm going to let everyone else duke this one out. I'm just going to watch from the sidelines.
Tom, you have something to say about this?
Well, Martin really, I think, explained the whole situation very eloquently. So there's not a lot to add other than, you know, understanding both sides of the story. And it's a complex issue. It's not a simple thing where we can just say he's right, she's right. I think everybody's a little right and everybody's a little wrong, you know, especially the way that Elon chose to handle this and the representative that, you know, her tweet was reprehensible. You know, that shouldn't be. You know, that certainly isn't becoming of a representative. You know, it's terrible that she would tweet something like that. But on Elon's side also, you know, he really comes off as a spoiled rich kid that's taken his ball to play in another playground because, you know, he's not allowed to just kick it wherever he wants to. You know, it's not good optics for him either. I understand the point where they have to get open. And, you know, they've pledged to, you know, implement all these safety features to keep workers as safe as possible. But he really just, you know, the way he came out with this on Twitter and now threatening to move the headquarters, who is he hurting with that? Is he hurting the, you know, dozen or so employees at the Alameda County Board of Health that made this determination that didn't want him to open? Okay, let's say all of them get fired over this and 10 people lose their jobs. Well, how about the thousands of Tesla employees that'll lose their jobs if he moves the headquarters to Texas? Are they just throwaway people that he doesn't care about because he has a personal vendetta with the Board of Health? He's just going to, you know, throw away thousands of jobs in California. That's no way to act either. So, I mean, you know, everybody's got mud on their face with this, and it's just the whole thing's unfortunate.
I think in his original tweet, he says it's like the final straw. So it might be a whole series of things leading up to this, you know, health officer, this lockdown order. But yeah, point taken. But yeah, and Texas would be happy to have them. They had a Hidalgo County, I believe, official, you know, tweeted out an invitation. And I think was it the governor of Colorado? Somebody in Colorado is also, you know, keen to invite them to move, set up shop there. But it does make it seem as if that Texas will be the site of the next Gigafactory or Terra Texas, possibly.
Yeah, so I just hope that the workers in California aren't the losers, right? Because they've been loyal to him. You know, it's been well documented that it's tough working for Tesla, that they're very demanding. But the people are still willing to do it because they believe in Tesla's mission. They love what Tesla's doing. But these people have worked really hard. And for Elon to just be so blasé about that, like, okay, we'll just close up shop and go to another state because you're not giving me my way. You know, that's the part of this whole thing that really, you know, makes me feel bad. I hope the Tesla workers don't end up being the loser because of a personal battle between Elon and some, you know, local officials. That's the big thing that would really bother me if that's what happens.
Right. Well, the Fremont factory, I think for sure that would be, I think it would be a big mistake and expensive to shut that down and move that production somewhere else. That makes like literally no sense. Other companies have moved their headquarters around the country a few times. I believe Toyota has. And yeah. But so, you know, it's, I can see doing that, but it's also not great because, you know, there's a lot of people at the headquarters there. It's, you know, I don't know if they do a lot of software work at the headquarters, especially, but, you know, California is a big, has a big pool of talent for software engineers, which is something that Tesla relies on. Although I've heard actually that Texas also has a lot of software engineering, but still the Silicon Valley has the reputation. And as our listener here, David Bodine, points out, it's tough to be a business in California, ? Yeah, I guess it depends on, you know, how lax you want. There's, you know, strong environmental regulation, which, you know, I personally think is a good thing. But, and people, there are, have been complaints about taxes, and certainly the cost of living for employers is very high. So people have to pay a lot of money as well. But this state also has a pretty strong economy, you know, overall. It's one of the largest economies in the world. If it was its own country, I think it's, what, sixth largest economy in the world or something like that? Anyway, but perhaps we should move on. So the cause of this whole situation is the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's also affected other OEMs, and that includes GM, who held a call this week to you know, tell us what's up with their EV program. And I got on that call actually, and I was expecting to hear, I was expecting to take all kinds of notes about delays of different vehicles. And I was a bit panicked about trying to keep up with everything, but not a whole lot to keep up with. You know, we've already seen that the Bolt EV has been, the refresh version has been delayed until next year. And the Cadillac Lyriq and the Hummer GMC reveals have been delayed. But, apparently, that's about it. The $20 billion they've allocated for the EV program until 2025, that they're targeting a million EVs on the road by 2025. So that money is still allocated. There's not been no cuts. The Cadillac Lyriq and GMC Hummer reveals will happen again. They will happen later this year. And so it's like business as usual. Party on, Wayne. Party on, Garth. Have you read about this, Martin?
Yeah, this is great news, because potentially companies could use this situation to change their plans. And I'm not being cynical and saying that anyone would follow a different ideological agenda that they really believed in, that they were, you know, we were forcing them to do EVs, they didn't really want to, and now they'll go, oh well, we've got to carry on making gas cars for the next 20 years. So that was my worry, is that some car companies might use this opportunity, or the situation, as an opportunity. And I don't think anybody has, by the way. But the great thing about GM's announcement was that they came out, and partly because of the call as well, so it was a, you know, good timing, like you say, and it was a good opportunity for those execs and VP level execs to talk to the journalists. But from all levels of the company, it's fantastic that GM are saying everything is on track. Sure, we're having our issues because some of the R&D programs and the development programs are getting to the stage where we would like to be doing things a little bit differently, so that perhaps some of those programs are being tweaked, but they're all on target. And in fact, we even heard one of the bits of news this week from one of the VPs, where all they mentioned to you on the call was that one program was actually being moved forwards rather than backwards. So we all thought, oh my goodness, they're gonna have to delay things, but actually one of the programs, and they wouldn't say what it is even being moved forward. Something like $25 billion worth of investment in their EV program, as the number we always quote, is difficult to say, well, where is that going, and what's been spent, and what's, is it over 5 years or 20 years? So these big numbers are always treat them with caution. But, you know, the overall big piece of news is absolutely fantastic from GM. And I think they're one of the big OEMs who totally get it with their brands, that they totally get we have to move to electrification. They're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They're still going to be making plenty of those fossil cars that I'm not really interested in, but they are the ones that generate some revenue and a bit of the kind of the cash cows, if you like, that those are the ones that are going to, well, Tom mentioned subsidizing earlier, they will subsidize the R&D programs and maybe even the EVs that come as well. So really good news. Well done, GM, not moving anything back. Everything is on plan, and congratulations to everyone at the company as well. Every company who's had to deal with this and keeping the plans on track and working from home as much as they can.
Yeah, GM still has there's a lot of cynicism out there in the EV world regarding GM, because you know they have one single plug-in vehicle available, and that originally was had much larger production targets. I believe they were talking about 50,000 back in 2015 or something, and they haven't lived up to that. But when you talk to the executive, like I've been able to sit in some meetings with some pretty high-level people, and they get it. They at least either that or they're really good actors. They see things coming to a head. And at some point, there's going to be a tipping, and all their energy is going to be their lineups are going to be pretty much exclusively electric eventually.
We've Maybe seen so. A lot of companies be able to pursue through this time. We did a story like podcast one, was it, with Rivian taking the cars home to work on software engineering. They had a car here in North Carolina. They were remoting in to work on the suspension. Ford was doing Mach-E testing away from home. Lucid has been putting out videos showing they can't wait to get their cars on the road. They're getting everything they can do in the back end. So it's amazing to me that companies are still staying on track. I think we only heard of one real casualty, which was the Lincoln electric vehicle with Rivian due to this pandemic. Everything other than that, at least up to this point, has been on track, maybe slightly delayed, but the cars will still get produced. And that's a huge thing.
And even with that Lincoln, Ford still has their own vehicle that they're going to do on the Rivian platform. So that hasn't been canceled. I don't think I was clear enough about that the last time we talked about that on the podcast. So the Lincoln is canceled, but there's still going to be a Rivian-based Ford of some kind or other. But we should move along real quick. So, Tom, you had a bit of a scoop this week. You want to tell us about it?
Sure. So I spoke with the folks over at Electrify America, just following up on a charging experience I had a couple weeks ago with Nissan Leaf, where I couldn't get it to charge to 100%. It kept shutting off at 98% on one of their DC fast chargers. I had to move over to the level 2 station and plug in to get it to 100% so I could start a range test. You obviously need to be at 100% charge when you begin a range test. And I think most customers would have just unplugged and left at that point, because they 98%, 100%, that really, it's negligible. But I needed 100%. So I reached out to Electrify America and I asked them to pull their logs to see what was going on with the charging station and why did it shut off. And basically they looked it up for me and told me that, look, the car was signaling to the charging station that it was 100% charged. The car was the one that was shutting off, not the charging station. So, that makes sense. I actually asked Nissan Leaf owners in one of my comments, I think on Twitter, has anybody else, noticed this and had the same issue where the car stops before it's 100% charged? But in any event, that conversation with Electrify America, while I had their CEO and president, Giovanni Palazzo, on the phone, I took the opportunity to, hit him with a few more questions, which he graciously stayed on the phone as long as I wanted to talk. We talked nearly an hour. We talked about a host of topics. But what really stood out to me was, when I asked them about, California changing the rules where they're going to require public charging stations to bill by kilowatt hour and to have displays so that the customer can see exactly how much kilowatt hour they're taking, what his take on that was, I figured, I was just going to get maybe a boilerplate answer, and he came right out and said, Tom, look, we've been thinking about this for a long time. When we started Electrify America, we honestly didn't know what was the right way to go. We had tons of discussion on this. Should we do kilowatt hour based? Should we do time based? Should we have tiers? And there is no clear in my opinion, there's no clear right way to do it. I could be a defense attorney and take the position that we could charge by time or charge by kilowatt hour. I think I could put up a good defense for both of those. Maybe even a combination of the two. Maybe it should be kilowatt hour and time based. But in any event, California, as usual, step forward and set the standard on what they want. And with electric vehicles, usually that means other states typically follow what California does. So that said, they have the level two charging stations, public charging stations, the new ones have to begin charging by kilowatt hour on 2021. And the new DC fast charge stations that get installed after 2023 have to bill by kilowatt hour. Now, the existing ones that are in have 10 years to switch over. So Electrify America could have been in a situation where half their chargers in the state charge by time, half their chargers charge by kilowatt hour. You know, it's just unworkable. So, you know, this kind of, I think, nudged them. Although Giovanni had told me that, look, we were full on considering this already, but it nudged them to say, you know what, this is the direction we should go in, and let's not wait till 2023. Let's figure out how we're going to do the billing and implement it as soon as we're ready. And so I asked him, well, is that just going to be for California? And he said, no, if this is the right way to go, then this is the right way to go. We'll do it everywhere we're allowed to. And I did a little bit of research, and it seems that about 30 states in the U.S. allow charging by kilowatt hour. And why do the other 20 not? Well, because you're not allowed to resell energy in those states. Only utilities are allowed to sell electricity. So you can't come in, buy electricity at a certain rate, and then resell it to people at another rate. It's like an essential commodity, and I think the Board of Utilities would be concerned that people would be price gouging, and it would lead us down the road that we don't want to go. So for now, at least, what Electrify America is going to do is they're going to phase this in state by state. They're going to allow kilowatt hour based charging in every state that it's allowed in, at least. And this might force a conversation to make the other states open up to allowing EV charging to have an exemption, let's say, of this, of this current rule that you can't recharge for electricity. We don't have an exact date when it's going to be in effect. We don't know what the rate's going to be. It doesn't mean that this is going to end up costing more or less for the customers. What it's going to do is it's going to make it so that everybody pays the same amount, because that's not the case right now. If I charge a Chevy Bolt and I get 50 kilowatt hours of energy, and then an Audi e-tron pulls up next and he gets 50 kilowatt hours of energy, we're going to pay different amounts. And I think that's the rub. That's what some customers have complained about, is that, it's not fair is what people are saying. And some people aren't. Some of the customers are saying, no, look, if he's on the station for a shorter period of time than I am, he should pay less, even if he gets more energy, because I'm using their charging station, that service. I'm renting that charging station for a certain period of time, so I should pay more. But then it goes back to the argument where, well, okay, the less expensive EVs, they charge at a lower rate. So now people that can only afford lower cost EVs pay more for their energy. Well, that's not fair either. So there's so many different things on this, that we have to consider. That's why I just want to say there's no one set right answer. So in Electrify America, I talked to them about that. They said, we understand this. We're going to spend a lot of time now trying to figure out what's the best way. So, when we say that they're going to switch to kilowatt hour based pricing, that doesn't mean it needs to be a set kilowatt hour based pricing. What they could do is say, when the car is from 0% charge to 50% charge, you pay 25 cents per kilowatt hour. Then when it's from 50% charge to 80% charge, it goes up to 30 cents a kilowatt hour. And when it's over 80% charge, you pay 50 cents a kilowatt hour. They could do something like that and it would still be allowed. I tried to press them to get me some kind of direction on where they're going. They would not bite on that. But we it's possible that we may get some sort of a pricing structure like that, while they promised me it's going to be very simple and easy to understand, probably wouldn't be three-tier like I just mentioned, possibly two-tier, maybe, you know, 0 to 75% and then over 75%. Reason why I think it's fair to charge more once the charging rate gets, once your state of charge is higher than 75% is because the cars dramatically slow down how much energy they take over 75 to 80% of state of charge. So what's happening is you're staying there longer to get less energy. And that is time on the charging station. I think people should be incentivized to charge to a certain percent and then get off that charging station, make room for the next car to pull in. Don't, you know, take 40 minutes for the last 10% unless you absolutely need it to get to the next charging station. So this was pretty big news as far as I'm concerned. We'll follow up on it once we get a little bit more information on how this is going to take effect, when it's going to take effect. But they promised me it's going to take effect well before the 2023 mandate.
Yeah, we've had a few, our community of Kona and Nero EV owners on the Inside EVs forum have not really been happy about the way the Electrify America pricing has been structured. Sometimes I'll see a comment like on Inside EVs, the news site, you know, in favor of the time-based and the tiered system. But generally, people like buy the kilowatt, you know, maybe it's because it's analogous to buying, you know, gasoline, you know, the energy unit per... We'll see how that goes, but we need to move along quickly if we're going to get through these. So the other big news is in Europe, the BYD Han is coming to Europe, and the expected pricing is 45,000, 55,000 euros, and this is their flagship model, and it's got some decent performance specs. It's 605 kilometers or 376 miles on the highly optimistic NEDC test, and it does 0 to 100 kilometers an hour, 62 miles an hour in 3.9 seconds. So it's nice and quick, and its styling is somewhat reminiscent of a Honda Accord. Martin, what do you think about this?
Yeah, so a quick bit of news from Europe, which I think is super exciting, and that's BYD, the Chinese company BYD, Build Your Dreams, are definitely looking at Europe as somewhere that they can sell their passenger vehicles, as well as they make a lot of commercial vehicles as well. So there's the SUV, which is the Tang. Now, the Tang is the first one that's coming, and both of these cars are coming to Norway first, by the way, biggest market in Europe, not by volume, but by EV. Half of all new cars every month sold have a pure EV, and three quarters have a plug socket on. So Norway makes sense because you're preaching to the converted. The first one's an SUV. It's called the Tang. It's got a big old battery, 82.8 kilowatt hour battery on this, and that's going to be the first one, but that hasn't got most of the attention. The attention is the Han that you mentioned, the H-A-N, the Han. That is going to be a swoopy saloon sedan, like a Tesla Model S, kind of, if you have to draw a line between that and an infamous Tesla. And this is going to be a really interesting car because, as you say, the budget is looking good for it, between 45 and 55 thousand. It's going to have plenty of range, not the range that they say, because they use NEDC. So when they say 376 miles, you can probably halve it. That's me being a little bit mean, but if you halved it, you wouldn't be far wrong. But they're using their new technology. Now, they've called it the Blade battery system, which does sound, it sounds like a superhero battery, doesn't it? The Blade battery. But I just think it's a good marketing term for there are no blades in the battery, but it is a new battery that is coming from BYD and their battery partners, and it is using the LFP cells, the LFP pouch cells. And so that is the lithium iron phosphate, so you get rid of the cobalt from the battery. And I always thought that these batteries were, you know, good for certain things, like the cost was low and they're more stable. You can puncture them. They're good for crashes, and it's very hard to get them to react in terms of runaway thermal events. However, the specs they've posted for the Han are incredible. 3.9 seconds, 0 to 62 miles an hour. So 0 to 100 Ks in less than 4 seconds. And that's a bit of an EV party trick, going quickly in a straight line to 60 miles an hour. But it's great. What I'm trying to say is the specs look really good for this. They've got their distribution partner in Norway, which is called RSA, because it's all well and good saying we're going to sell a car, but Where do I take it back to when it breaks down? If it breaks down, what regular servicing, for instance, regardless of breaking down. So yeah, RSA in Norway are going to be their partners there. So we'll see how they go. A big Chinese maker, big presence in the US, of course, in California, making commercial vehicles. But we'll see how they go with passenger cars in Europe. Be interesting to know how many people would actually go and spend their own hard-earned money on one of these. I'm really curious. The options are good. The battery sizes are good. 66 and 77 kilowatt hour options for two-wheel drive and all-wheel drive. Everything looks good. As EV people and you watching this show, everything, like, they've hit the basics. So, but more than that as well, really exciting. But it's a brand that many people will never have owned in their driveway. So that right. might be the hurdle to overcome.
Yeah, BYD, Build Your Dreams, has always been pretty ambitious to expand worldwide. And there's been stories over time of them trying to get into America somehow. And they've managed to with their buses, but not yet personal vehicles. And maybe this this European expansion will presage what's coming to our shores. So would you take the BYD Han over the new Fiat 500 electric first edition? Coming up for sale, it's almost all sold out.
The La Prima edition. La Prima. God, it's such a good looking car. It's gorgeous. It's a small car because it's the Fiat 500, and it's not the Fiat 500 that you may think of that has been on sale up until now, which was the compliance car sold in California and some other places as well. This is a It looks the same. The styling is the same,
similar.
But it's built from the ground up as an EV. The pricing is plus or minus, near as damn it, about £30,000, euros, depending on specs. It puts it a smidgen cheaper than the Honda E. It's going to be in that same area as the Mini that we've talked about as well. It's a step up in terms of price from the Vauxhall / Opel Corsa E and the Peugeot E208. Big cars here. And so it's a premium small car. Look, it looks amazing from the outside. It's a soft top. It's convertible. It's electric. The inside looks great. The styling is fantastic. Designed from the ground up as a pure EV. And they reckon 899 miles on WLTP, so not far off real world as well. It's a really nice looking car.
Can you bring up a picture? Can you bring up a picture of that real quick? So this price too is like it's a $500 or 500 euro deposit, $539 US. So $37,900. They raised the price apparently by 400 euros. So that's about $40,000, $877. $40,877. But this is the launch edition though. So this is like fully loaded car. Eventually other models will be cheaper than this, but this is like the first ones coming out. I think each country that it's sold in is getting like 500 units allocated to them. Yeah. I've driven the 500D and I really like it. And I like the way it looks, but I wasn't sure if I'd like this one as much. Is it bigger than the original 500D?
I think it's about this. It's a bit more room inside. I think because it's a custom-made EV from the ground up. But if we can bring some pictures up of this as well, it just looks, you know, the styling of it is just fantastic as well. Here we go. Yeah, we got a nice gallery on inside EVs that
there's something so special about a convertible electric car. I think up to this point, the Smart Electric's been the only one in production. I own it. I love it. It is amazing hearing the sounds of nature as you drive past in silence. This is going to be a cool car.
Yeah, I like it. Still not like the full kind of convertible, though. I would still like to see something come up with it. Like the actual, I got to drive a convertible last summer, a Ford Mustang of all things, on a road trip where there wasn't a lot of charging in. That was what I had to drive. And actually, beside the energy, the propulsion, the drivetrain, I really liked it. It was, I loved having the roof down, and actually that vehicle actually handles really nice on like a long trip. It was pretty impressive. So yeah, I'm waiting to see something electric come with no roof option. But that's pretty close. That's pretty nice. I like the way it zips down in the back. But no word whether this is coming to the US or not. If it's hugely popular in Europe, maybe we'll see something That would be nice.
They need to, obviously, the compliance car they made was massively loss-making for every one they sold. This, will they say, is designed to make a profit, which is a good thing. And also, the specs are good on it as well. I can't recall the battery size, but I know that it's got really good charge speeds as well, less than 100 kilowatts. But it holds its own in terms of the specs, and it's not cheaped out on the technology either.
I'm pretty sure, Martin, it's 42 kilowatt hour battery pack on this vehicle. And I too like the 500D. I drove the last generation one. Fun little car to drive. But I'm kind of looking at this like I looked at the Mini Cooper SE. This launch package version is like, it goes up to $43,000 US. I don't think that's the version to buy of this car. Like the Cooper SE, then Kyle and I were driving it. We both, I think, came to the conclusion that the Iconic package was really nice, and it was like $37,000 and change. But the real version to buy of those cars are the base versions, where you can get them for like $30,000. The value is so much better for this smaller car than really loading it up with all these crazy options. I mean, when you're getting to 40, like I said, it's $43,000 fully loaded, this launch version. I mean, you could think of the other EVs you could have for that, for $43,000.
I would argue that people who are going to spend $43,000 on this already own a Model S or X or 3 or an e-tron or I-Pace, and this is their daily runabout. Like, I have the Model 3 that sits in the garage 99% of the time. I can do all my daily driving in the Smart, and then when I go on a trip, I take the Tesla. So I think this is where that's going to fall into place. I'd be curious to see what equipment a base one comes with. And Martin, you made the Honda E comparison. That is just such a, I'm so jealous you get that car, because it is so cute. It's so cool. And finally, Honda's done something interesting for like the first time in the last 20 years. They used to be amazing. And so I'm all about the Honda E. And as soon as 25 years passes, I'm importing one into the US, and that will be my daily driver.
they should carve out an exception for that 25-year rule for electric vehicles, I think. You know?
Yeah, I want to drive a Honda E every day with the little mirrors that are video cameras and the cute little interior. It's got amazing tech. I love it. I'm all about the Honda E.
Yeah. It doesn't have the performance. I like, wish it had a bit more juice there, but it does have like amazing design inside and out. It's just... Oh.
Yeah, it'll get you to the grocery store with a huge smile on your face, and that's all that matters.
They really nailed the design, I have to admit. I've sat in one a couple times at different auto shows,
nice.
And it is just, it makes you smile sitting in it. It's really a cool little EV. Don't rule out completely the U.S. getting it eventually. Let's see. You know, it's at some point Honda is going to, run up against the ZEV credits and have to, sell more ZEVs here or buy the credits. And, they might say, let's bring it over to the U.S. If they don't have something else, in the pipeline that's going to sell enough copies by that time, at least.
It's pretty. The Honda E has pretty short range, though. So I think to make it a value that would draw people in, a compelling value, they would need to really come down on that price. Yeah.
It's something like 125 miles on WLTP.
Right.
For the Honda. This is not a car that you, and it charges quickly, but this is not a car that you are, is going to be probably your long distance road tripping car. As Kyle says, it's a car that you're going to jump in, and it's just going to put such a huge smile on your face. You actually love driving this. And when you're not driving it, you can always plug in your little Nintendo handset controller to the USB, and you can play video games on that entire, on the dash that goes the entire width of the car. And if you don't want to do that, you can feed the fish. You can turn the dashboard into an aquarium.
They have nailed it on this car.
If you tap it, little chunks of food come down. You tap the screen, you can feed the fish. Who doesn't need that in their EV? This should be in all cars.
That's right.
Yeah, Martin's on the right track here. This is why we're friends. You and I think alike. Every car needs a fish tank so you can keep your fish fed in the screen.
There was a Chinese car manufacturer at the Detroit Auto Show maybe 10 years ago brought a concept over that had an actual fish tank in the car with like fish.
Live fish, not
you're right, not virtual fish. So, yeah. Anyway, so moving on, the last final story. Ford has given us more details about their over-the-air updating for the Mustang Mach-E. And they're telling us that most of the updates will take 2 minutes or less to perform, and longer ones can be scheduled. Nearly all the different systems within the Mach-E can be updated over the air, as in, which is contrary to, you know, some of their traditional vehicles, which, you know, maybe only the sync, the entertainment, the infotainment systems can be updated. Then this morning, we got a fresh bit of news from them that the Mach-E also can charge faster than they originally had expected. So now they're saying that you can get maybe 60 in 10 minutes, or the time that it takes to get a slice of pizza. They say it can charge up 61 miles of, you can put in, you know, plug in 61 miles. And that is in with, the, but that's with the rear wheel drive extended battery version. So anyone had a chance to look this story over?
Well, I think it's important to note that I'm sure the charging peak speeds is the same for the rear-wheel drive big battery as it will be for their dual motor offering. It's just going to be that their heavier cars are a little bit less efficient, which means that your miles per hour of charge rate or kilometers per hour of charge rate will be lower because the cars are less efficient. I see this all the time at Tesla forum, someone in a Model X who's pulling 150 kilowatts, like, my car is only charging at 400, and a Model 3 rear-wheel drive is like, well, mine's doing 600 miles per hour, even though they're getting the same 150 kilowatts of power. Sure. Faster charging is always welcome, and I am so happy Ford is putting a true effort into this car. I'm getting more and more excited for Mach-E every single day. This is going to be a real winner.
And there's some news in this as well about their Ford Pass charging network, an additional 1,000 electric vehicle charging stations and 5,000 charge plugs. They're partnered with Electrify America, who we spoke about earlier. Yeah, Tom, you have some thoughts on this?
Well, one thing that I do like when we're talking about the over-the-air updates, and I've mentioned this before in the air, what I really like that Ford's doing is they've kind of conceded that Tesla has a good model and their customers like it, so they're emulating that. And that's important. It seems like a lot of the other OEMs are wanting to make their electric vehicle programs just an extension of their core products and just kind of adjusting it a little bit so that their customer experience is the same, just a little bit different for their electric vehicles. But it seems like Ford just threw that out the window and said, no. You know what? These new guys over in California, they kind of have tapped into something. They've touched a nerve what people like. So let's take a look at what they're doing and bring it over to what we're doing, but put our own, you know, spin on it. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with copying to some extent what another successful automaker or company of any product has done. So, you know, that's what I take from what Ford's doing with the Mustang Mach-E a lot. The whole user experience, the whole layout of the interior and everything, it's very Tesla-esque. You can't deny that. And that's a good thing. So I'm happy to see that Ford recognized that, look, you know, Tesla isn't just like, they haven't just gotten lucky and had people love their cars. There's a reason why Tesla owners love their cars. It's a really good user experience. They love the over-the-air updates. So let's see how we can take what we've learned from what Tesla's doing and implement it in the Ford way. So like Kyle, I'm really excited and looking forward to the Mach-E. I can't wait to really try out the whole user infotainment system and just see how well it feels engineered to accommodate what an electric vehicle owner wants, not just a Ford product that is electric. So I'm really looking forward to getting behind the wheel of that car and checking it out. Now, as far as the charge rates, that's great. You know, I don't think that's a surprise to Ford. You know, it's not like their engineers one day woke up and said, "Oh wow, it charges faster than we thought it would." I think, you know, they probably didn't want to announce something that they couldn't guarantee until they did all the thorough validation. And, you know, there's also a little bit of gamesmanship when cars are being introduced. A lot of times the OEMs won't reveal the full details at first, and that way they can give you little crumbs as the car is along. Oh, look, this is better than what we thought it would be. And this, we're going to have faster over-the-air updates, and we're going to have faster charging. And wow, you know, the car is even better than we originally promised. This isn't the first time we've seen that. There's nothing wrong with that. So it's great to hear that the car is going to seem to be very capable DC fast charging. And again, can't wait to get a hands on one, test it out, charge it up, and report to the Inside EVs community.
So just to throw this metric out there real quick, so both the all-wheel drive and the rear-wheel drive configurations are estimated to achieve a 10% to 80% charge in approximately 45 minutes while on a DC fast charging station, just to kind of, you know, put all that into perspective. But we're past our hour a little bit, and so we should wrap things up. That brings us to the end of our show. I'd like to thank you all for joining us. And gentlemen, thank you very much for your participation. And if you have any comments about any of the topics on today's show, you can leave them on the Inside EVs podcast post or on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread or in the YouTube comments as well. And don't forget, you can find and follow our panelists here on Twitter. Tom Longy is at Tomolog, T-O-M-M-O-L-O-G. Martin is at EV News Daily. Kyle, you're at out of spec, out underscore of underscore spec, and I'm at Dominic with an E underscore Y. Click and subscribe to and tap that bell notification for you're right. And anyway, I'm done being tongue-tied, so we'll see you all next week, and thanks for joining us.